to eat crow. School was becoming less and less important to me. I was constantly getting suspended for fucking off or being late or sometimes not showing up at all. And that always killed me, getting suspended. The idea of being told that you can't go to school as punishment for not going to school. Perfect. I missed the class trip to an amusement park when I broke my jaw, or more accurately, when my brother broke my jaw for me. We're fucking around and he put me in a headlock standing up and he squeezed until I passed out. He assumed I was faking it. Faking it was always my go-to defense, and then he let me go unconscious, face first onto the concrete basement floor. And I had to have my jaw wired for weeks. No solid food, and worse, no way to brush the insides of your teeth. Yuck! Mother brought me from the hospital to Friendly's Ice Cream, where all I could order was a milkshake, the Friendly Fribble. Chocolate Fribble, I ordered through clenched teeth. Hold the onions. It broke Mother into hysterics far beyond the value of the joke, and it was the one joke she annoyingly retold more often than any other for the rest of her life. But any time I could make her laugh hard was a solid victory. The threat of puking on a roller coaster with my jaw wired shut banned me from the class trip. I can see where it made sense. Other things I was sent home for didn't make sense. I was sent home by a gym teacher once for wearing a t-shirt Mother had bought me on the road. It was for an alleged bar, and it said, "Liquor up front, poker in the rear." It's hackneyed now, but at the time it was fucking hilarious, and I remember arguing very calmly and concisely that due to the spelling of liquor up front, poker in the rear, it could only be considered offensive if the reader decided to interpret it in that fashion. Therefore, he, the gym teacher, was the one with the dirty mind. The teacher conceded that I was perhaps correct, but sent me home to change my clothes anyway. And at home, I found an audaciously gaudy polyester pantsuit in these loud, multicolored swirls that my stepmother had in the laundry. I decided to wear that to school the next day with a Flava Flav style clock around my neck. I lasted about 2 periods before I'm sent home again. I argued that there was no dress code, and this couldn't be considered offensive by any means, like the t-shirt had been deemed so. So what? I'm being sent home as a matter of your own personal taste? I was told that I was a distraction, and this time when they sent me home, they called my father. The next day was the last day of school, so suspending me was moot. And they decided that the proper punishment was to make me wear a coat and tie on the last day, which backfired when everyone thought I was doing this as yet another goof and found it funnier still, and that was the end of Chandler Junior High School for me. I already got beaten up for the title of class clown, which is all I really wanted out of school anyway. A girl on the student committee of whoever does that kind of shit told me she'd been one of the vote counters and she was sure that I'd won. She said the powers that be on the faculty had changed the results. And maybe that's why I'm such a conspiracy theorist now. I don't remember who got my title, but they will go down to their grave knowing it was an inside job. The next year would be on to Doherty High School. And I don't remember much of anything except that it had a smoking area for students outside during breaks. Very strange to imagine now. I mostly remember rarely showing up. In our system, you went to Chandler Junior through 9th grade and Doherty High School 10 through 12. I showed up occasionally halfway through 10th and quit the day I turned 16, the minimum age when you're allowed to do that. My dad wasn't all that happy about it. Seeing as how he worked for the school department, it probably looked bad, but he deferred to Mother, who allowed it on the condition that I got my GED and that I look for a job. I always contended that quitting school was one of the best decisions I've ever made in my life. There was nothing there that interested me. I couldn't pay attention even when I tried my hardest. I probably have some form of dyslexia, which is why Chad Shank is reading half this book so we can do it in fucking time. Writing this book made me sure I had dyslexia, but even if I'd been solidly diagnosed as dyslexic in that school, it wouldn't have made it any less boring. School was just mundane and pointless. It started far too early. It's always baffled me that if everyone hates getting up early, why set the hours that way? Why can't it be noon to 8 instead of 9 to 5? If school started at 11 a.m. instead of 7 a.m., maybe I'd have a useless diploma instead of this worthless GED. And if I had to take my GED test today, I'd fail miserably because nothing I was forced to know in school ever came up in real life. I was disinterested in class. I was generally terrified on the schoolyard. There was no payoff in a diploma and no allure in any occupation that would require one. I was about to get a jump start on real life. The only problem was, I was only 16 years old. What I really wanted to do was get the fuck out of Worcester. POW was driving truck for Dart Transit out of Shakopee, Minnesota, and he let me go on runs with him as a lumper, getting out on the loading docks and unloading shit into the warehouse. POW would kill the miles with war stories, the how to kill a guy with a credit card kind of shit, explain the term Colombian necktie and whatnot. I learned CB radio lingo and could fuck with other truck drivers, just like making prank phone calls back home. I don't think I've ever slept better in my life than in the bunk of a moving 18-wheeler, including one LAX to Heathrow trip on Virgin Atlantic first class on a full bar of Xanax. Sleeping that well made getting out of the freezing truck at 6 o'clock in the morning to hump boxes that much more debilitating. I remember a cold morning in Grand Rapids where I had to unload like 30,000 pounds of Cocoa Krispies before breakfast, one case at a time. Trucking was fun for a while, but like a kid with progeria syndrome, it got old quick. Back in Worcester, a POW had talked to his mother in New Jersey, who told him she was going to be renting out a room in her house to bring in some desperately needed income. Mother and POW knew that I wanted to get out of Dad's house and thought it would be a great idea for me to move down in New Jersey. POW's mother was a yellow-gray corpse color of indeterminate age who looked like that new lady they just hired at the corner store here in Bisbee across from the baseball field. How's that for a reference you don't get? Fuck you. She lived in Maywood, New Jersey, outside of Hoboken in this creaky, dark Victorian house full of lots of old people shit. Afghan throws over the backs of wooden rocking chairs. It was a fucking horror movie set. And his mother, I have no clue what her name was, slept no more than 4 hours a night, and the rest of the time she spent literally rocking in a chair, looming over you to make sure you didn't do anything against the house rules. And the house rules were, don't do anything. If you stirred a cup of coffee with a spoon, that spoon shouldn't hit a countertop for even a second. It should be washed and put away immediately, and you were an ingrate if you didn't know to do that on your own. I needed to find a job quick, and I did. I got a job at the Maywood IGA grocery store, stocking shelves. It was shit money, but it gave me somewhere to be. The store was owned by an Italian father and son team who seemed mob-affiliated, not the well-dressed, kill-people-in-the-basement type of mobster, more like the connected type that makes pasta and launders money for the cool mobsters, that kind of mobster. They were nice enough, and they paid in cash, and they ignored my poor work ethic for almost a month before I was fired for eating more food off the shelves than I was stocking. So I left New Jersey, but not with my tail between my legs. Oh no, you can't fail at leaving New Jersey. Bruce Springsteen failed by staying, loser. And now, once again, thank Christ, Chad Shank.
So now I was back at Dad's house with a stepmother who hated me and a stepsister that I was constantly fighting with, and my dad trying his best to keep everything smooth. He knew I didn't want to be there, and I knew everything would be easier once I was gone, but I was still 16. So for the next year and a half, we just have to sit there and stare at our watches till I turned 18 and could beat feet somewhere else. The other problem I had was that all my friends were still in school, so I didn't have anyone to hang around with during the day. Even my brother was leaving now. He joined the Marine Corps on the delayed entry program. This is where they sign you up at 17, so that when you turn 18 and can actually smell freedom to the point where it's real, it's too late. You're fucked. Sure enough, in the year between first signing the papers to actually getting his head shaved, he'd gotten in a band, had a couple of different girlfriends, and was almost popular. He knew there were ways to get out of it, but didn't want to look like a coward. He looked like that his whole life, he thought. So he sucked it up and headed to Paris Island for boot camp. 13 weeks later, I took the Greyhound bus with his then-fiancée Jody 28 hours to South Carolina to watch him graduate. I really looked up to him at this point in my life. We went through a lot of shit together where it seemed like we were outnumbered and outgunned, and we only had each other to count on. Now he was going to be a Marine, and I was truly proud of him. The night before the ceremony in the hotel, I saw an opportunity, a moment of beer-induced weakness that I took advantage of, and I fucked his fiancée. Hoorah! Wasn't just payback for finger-fucking my girlfriend back in Paxton. Shit was getting very incestuous around now. I'd started dating Jeff's most recent ex-girlfriend, Christine. She was gorgeous, artsy, kind of punk rockerish, and very intelligent. All very rare qualities, even in the far reaches of our social circles. How the fuck, then, would she wind up with Jeff or me? Oh, that's right. She was 18 and already had 2 children, dropping her stock down to Stanhope levels. I'm guessing a lot of people will think teenage mothers are normal. It certainly wasn't where we grew up. So when Christine dumped my brother, he started going out with his best friend Jeff Brown's recent ex, Jody, and they got engaged, much to Jeff Brown's annoyance. Then I started dating Christine, and after that ended, I banged Jody while Jeff was in boot camp. In the end, all parties involved were part of Jeff and Jody's wedding party. It's not that important to the rest of the story. It's just funny that we never had any clue that we were white trash.
So now I'm alone. I went to Job Corps for a very short time. Job Corps is like reform school that you sign up for voluntarily, where they teach you a skill and pay you basically prison wages while you try to not get killed by the serious dregs of troubled youth that surround you, hardcore deviant criminal element. Fuck that, I can learn to master culinary arts on my own. I left in a hurry, but I started hanging out with a couple kids that I met there since they were dropouts as well. One of them was Keith Kingsbury. Keith Kingsbury was the last person in the world that you'd want your wayward teenage son to start hanging out with, unsupervised, at your house with nothing but idle time. Keith really was a bad seed of the kind I hadn't known before. Chris O'Connor was a delinquent, but Keith had a rap sheet. He was always getting arrested, usually for petty shit. He'd always have warrants for unpaid tickets, speeding, no insurance, suspended license, expired tags. Yet he'd still be speeding with no license or tags, with active warrants now, so he'd get pulled over again and go to jail again and not pay the fine again. So long as it was him going to jail and not me, I thought it was funny. We landed jobs at a 24-hour diner in downtown Worcester, working the graveyard shift, Keith cooking, me waiting the counter, and the place is right across the street from the only gay bar in town. So at last call, the place was transformed into a gay diner. I might be ugly now, but when I was 17, I looked 13, and I was cute as a fucking bug. Parachute pants were all the rage, and I soon realized what any hot chick in the service industry knows, that tight pants scored big tips. Sometimes folks at the gay bar would send someone over just to see if I was wearing my parachute pants before they decided if they'd even come in at all. Didn't matter to me at all what sexuality they were. I just relished the adulation. I even dressed in drag to work on Halloween. There was a middle-aged couple, swingers, who came in regularly and they flirted with me to no end. Her name was Cookie, and she always threatened, "We're going to take you home with us one of these nights." And I always played along, knowing that my shift doesn't get over till 7 a.m., so I have an easy excuse. Act interested, get the tips, have an out. It was like titty dancing. The owner of the place was a guy named Simeone Breo, who went by Simi, an old boozy, hardened hustler who also turned out to be gay, which shocked the shit out of us because he was a hard ass who looked like Nick Nolte's DUI mugshot. I was always comfortable with gay people, not a popular attitude in lowbrow Worcester. Some of Mother's best AA friends were flaming, and they were fun, and they were never a threat. But Simi was a revelation, the first guy I'd ever known to be gay that you bought as a legitimate tough guy. At the diner, when the glut of the post-last call queens moved out, the wee hours at the diner were left mostly to transients and stumble bums. Lots of homeless. There's one guy who'd come in, he'd order coffee, and then he'd go to sleep with his head in his arms right over the counter. And I'd wake him up and tell him he couldn't sleep there over and over, and he'd just end up falling back asleep. Finally, I walked into the kitchen one night, and I grabbed an 8-quart metal cooking pot with a metal soup ladle with a small audience of patrons and Keith watching in anticipation. I leaned the pot at an angle just over his sleeping head and then proceeded to wail away on it with the ladle. And he shot up like he was inside John Bonham's drum kit. And shortly afterwards, a reporter from the local paper, the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, came in doing a story of Worcester after hours and talked to me about what it was like working overnight downtown. And I repeated the soup pot on the homeless dude story, it being one of my favorites, and it got printed. I couldn't understand why Simi went through the fucking roof. It was wicked funny. I couldn't wrap my head around why stories of homeless people not only sleeping in the diner but also being abused could be bad for a new business. It didn't matter. Mother bought every copy of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette she could get her hands on. At the time I was working graveyard shift at the diner, Mother started going to massage school just down the street. Truck driving had lasted as long as most of her other ventures, and now she was going to go to the Bancroft School of Massage on a loan from my grandmother, which wasn't really a loan. She didn't have to pay it back, as Grammy had recently died of lung cancer. We'd have to go see Grammy in the hospital, most of the time with Jeff and I waiting outside the hospital room smoking cigarettes in the hallway. Yes, you could smoke in school and hospitals. They were wonderful days. Grammy was always someone that Jeff and I had to endure rather than enjoy. We looked forward to her greeting cards on birthdays or Christmas, and we just shook them out without reading them to see how much money fell to the floor. But spending time with her was arduous, even for Mother. Mother had been an only child whose father died at 42. As a child and through her adulthood, Mother could never live up to her own mother's expectations. Her accomplishments were always passive-aggressively torn down. Every compliment was backhanded. After my mother died, I found a letter she wrote to Grammy on January 7th, 1963. Mother was 17 and in high school while working in a nursing home, and evidently Mother and Grammy had had a tiff. The letter reads,
"Dear Momsy, I'm sorry I acted like such a stinker. I hope this is all caused by my being all worn out, because if it isn't, I'll go nuts living with myself for the rest of my life. I didn't mean to make you feel unwanted when I said I wanted to go to the doctor by myself. But when I overheard you telling Rose that you had to take Bonnie to the doctor's, I felt like a 2-year-old. That's why I said it. I want you to go with me tomorrow. But may I ask one favor? Please let me talk to him myself. I do feel that I am old enough to tell him my own symptoms. I don't mean to be sarcastic by that either. Sometimes you have a tendency to exaggerate and mix up information. Then I have to tell it over again, and I don't like to do that, because it might seem to make you out a liar. And that isn't true. Do you see what I mean? Another thing is I haven't told you all the things I feel are wrong with me because I don't want you to worry. I just wanted to sit by myself and tell him about all my little aches and pains, okay? I hope that when I get rested up and get some of these tensions to leave, we could do things together. I hate being mean to you, and I don't do it on purpose. It's just that by the time I get home, I'm fed up with people in general, and little things get on my nerves. Sometimes at work, I get so mad at people, I could reach out and strangle them, but I have to live with them, and I can't. You know that I'm not the type to yell at people or tell someone off. And with being tired and run down and tense and having to put up with little irritants, I get so keyed up that I take it out on you. I hope that after a little time, I could calm down and take life a little easier. Mom, Russ thinks that once I quit work, I should join the Y or something. He thinks that I'll get into a rut if I just go to school and do homework and stay around the house. But I'm scared stiff at the thought of meeting other people and being rejected. I've never gotten along with people, and I feel like a sore thumb around them. Even in school, I hate to walk down the corridor. I could just feel people staring at me and saying, "Boy, is she ever a fink." Sometimes I'd rather die than walk through them. I just feel that people would be happier if I weren't around. I think I'm a regular oddball. I feel so stupid around other kids, I could just die. And that's one of the reasons I hate to leave work. At least I know that the people, especially the patients, like having me around. Maybe someday I'll adjust. So will I see you tomorrow? I really want you to come. I'm awfully sorry. Lots of love, Bonnie.
I know that feeling too, Ma. I used to walk down the hallways of Paxton Center School so afraid, feeling that I was walking funny, that everyone was staring at me, that everyone was making fun of me. And the more aware of it I became, the more I seemed unable to control my legs. And I wanted to die too, Ma, but I knew you had my back. My mother was always overly conscious to make sure she let me be my own person, or force me to be my own person. She'd never even order for me in a restaurant. I'd go hungry before she'd ever tell the waiter what I wanted for myself. I understand that now. She was deeply affected by her own upbringing to the end and was deliberate to not hobble her own children in the same way. When Grammy finally kicked the bucket, all we cared about was when we got our inheritance, which Jeff and I coined Grandma's dead money, never not laughing when we said it. It seemed like an eternity before it showed up, and we're pretty sure Mother grifted us out of a lot of it beforehand. Mother had been made power of attorney while Grammy was still alive and taking care of her bills, and using some presumptive arithmetic, after seeing how little we eventually received, we figured Mother had moved the lion's share into her own bank account before Grammy ever died. Mother's massage classes started shortly after I'd leave work in the morning from the diner, and it worked out where I could be used as a test dummy in class and get free massages. It was an unbelievable perk, as I always left work with my back in agony. I've had the hunched spine of a defeated man since I was old enough to care when a girl pointed it out. My seahorse posture was made for drinking over a dive bar, looking through the bottom of my glass long before I was old enough to be served there. Working for a living only seemed to aggravate it. One morning I was at her school, covered on a slab, on my back like a naked cadaver when the class started. After a brief tutorial from the instructor, one of the class members started going up and down my leg. I immediately threw wood like it was going to leave my body and stick into the ceiling. I'm 17 years old and some girl is rubbing her hands up my lubricated inner thigh. What could possibly go wrong? I was mortified. I'm laying in front of a class of 20 or so people, one of them being my mother, while sporting a no-nonsense boner through a thin white sheet. All I could do was pretend to be asleep. This is the rare instance of something I could call a traumatic experience in my youth, in that I've never to this day been able to enjoy a legitimate massage without fear of inadvertently getting an obvious hard-on. I'd rather go to any yank house out by the airport where they expect to give you a hand job at the end and just leave them wanting more. We also suspected that a lot of the transferred dead money was going to buy POW his own big rig. I don't know if that ever came to be, as they were having relationship trouble. He'd gone off the wagon. Mother got him into rehab. He was going to be in for 30 days. And during that time, he said I could use his old Chevy Love pickup truck. And he warned me that it leaked oil as much as 2 quarts a day, says POW. I was just happy to have a ride. I could, with some training from friends, probably figure out something as foreign to me as checking the oil. And I did. And I checked the oil relentlessly, terrified that if I didn't, the whole thing would explode. I was always afraid of shit exploding. Mother and I even shared an irrational fear of balloons. I checked that oil twice a day, and for days it never registered as low. So trusting POW's estimate of 2 quarts a day of oil, I eventually assumed that the dipstick must be broken. With my below-sea-level mechanical skills and trust in POW, what else could I think? So I started putting in 2 quarts of oil a day, regardless of the dipstick. Before long, I noticed the truck is getting extremely sluggish. Soon, when I would floor the gas at a green light, plumes of thick white exhaust smoke would fill the intersection, so thick that traffic behind me would come to a standstill. Eventually, I asked Keith to look at it. He knew cars. He opened up the hood, and there was so much oil in it, it had filled the carburetor and was spilling into the air filter. And I learned a valuable lesson that day. The lesson was that you could have Batmobile options, like massive smoke screens at the touch of a gas pedal, for the price of just 2 quarts of oil a day. We drove around fumigating traffic every day until POW got out of rehab. I can't remember if it was the Chevy Love or one of the many other fleeting hunk of shit cars I owned during those days, but I do recall driving into the lot of Sunnyside Ford in the middle of the night in Holden, Mass. I don't know if Keith was behind the wheel or if it was me, but we proceeded to drive at high speeds in reverse into the sides of brand new cars, demolition derby style, before disappearing into the night. They had insurance, so no one really was affected. That was our rationalization for the project. We wouldn't do this to some poor prick who had to get up on a winter morning for work and deal with this shit. We're good people. And we believed that. When I was writing this book, I had to Google search Sunnyside Ford. And I go, since it's on my screen anyway, I'm just going to call him. I'm going to tell him this story. Remember like 1984, some dude was crashing into your cars and stuff. But I'm writing about it in a book. And you could just feel the guy's eyebrows furrow going, what the fuck are you talking about? Yeah, no, I'm writing a book and we crashed into your cars. We thought it was funny. It wasn't funny. Sorry. And then I just said, fuck it. I'll send you a copy of the book. Usually, it was always Keith that got arrested. I got away with everything for a while. I scored a job at Honey Farms, a convenience store right in Tatnik Square by my dad's house at 20 Rich Street, where I'd worked the register and after a short training period was left to work by myself, a huge blunder on their part. It wasn't just that my friends and I would simply steal. We'd see how much we could steal and then try to break our record the next time. And not just cigarettes, which we took by the cartons for ourselves or just gave away to friends who'd come in. We'd leave with food, soda, snacks, diapers for Christine's kids, kitchen supplies that we did or didn't need, just for volume. A few years earlier, I used to hang out at Honey Farms, generally just causing trouble and being a pain in the ass to the clerk, who was the older brother of a kid I went to school with. One day he told me I had to leave, and I refused. So he chased me up and down the aisles until he caught me, and he tripped me up while holding my hands behind my back. And I went down on my chin without being able to break my fall, and my chin opened up like a baby's vagina. Mother closed it up with a butterfly stitch. She knew she could have sued the shit out of him, but she also knew it was my fault for being a fuckhead. I assumed my massive theft was a small price to pay in comparison to what we could have sued them for. There was no security cameras, but the store had a separate back entrance where security could come in and secretly watch you through this one-way mirror. I never believed they actually did. I assumed I would have been able to hear them come in. And the night I found out I was wrong, the security guy got quite a show. Not only had I been stealing from the register by not ringing up purchases and giving away the store to any friend that showed up, but Keith had come by, and we went at the place like it was the LA riots. We dumped 2-liter bottles of 7-Up down the sink, refill them with water, and put them back on the shelves. We were just incredible dicks. We played football with loaves of bread. At the end of my shift, just before I locked up, Honey Farm security came in through the front. He'd seen the whole show from behind the one-way mirror. He didn't have to say a word. I immediately knew I was fucked. I had to write out a statement. I didn't have to, but I didn't know I didn't have to. I thought I had to. A confession. I signed it. Although I did my best to minimize it, it still looked fucking awful. I was charged with petty larceny. Fortunately, I only admitted to stealing $35 in cash, so it wasn't a felony. I wasn't arrested, but I had to go to court, so it made the local paper in the courthouse records section. My parents were not thrilled. Not long afterwards, Keith was pulled over just at the foot of Rich Street, 3 houses away from mine, for yet another traffic stop. I was in the passenger seat. Of course, he had an outstanding warrant and was arrested. They told me to wait across the street while they called a paddy wagon. Keith didn't like cops and hated getting arrested, and he let the cop know that in no uncertain terms. Screams came from the back of the paddy wagon after they put him in there. Fuck you, you fucking pig motherfucker! Take off that badge and gun and see how fucking tough you are, you fucking faggot! Your mother sucks cocks in hell! Meanwhile, I'm literally down on the sidewalk, rolling in laughter. I'd never seen anyone confront an authority figure like that. I couldn't believe anyone had the balls to talk like that to a cop. So the cop walks over to me, jumped on top of me while I'm rolling around laughing with his knee in my back and said, "Oh, you think it's funny? You're under arrest for disturbing the peace." And the next thing I know, Keith and I are both on our way to Worcester City Jail. It was mostly empty, save for Keith and me in our own cells. We didn't get strip searched, just made to empty our pockets and sit in our cells until my friend Stan Cohen bailed us out within an hour or so. When my court date arrived, I pleaded not guilty because I was not fucking guilty of anything but laughing. And I believe cops should be held to the same standards as the citizens they're sworn to protect. If he were not a cop and just tackled and shackled me for nothing but laughing on a sidewalk, I would have been well within my rights to shoot him in the fucking face to get away. In fact, I'd be hailed as a hero for doing so. The headline would read, "Quick thinking youth evades kidnapper with swift shot to the face. Keeps laughing." I didn't have this argument when I went to court, which is probably a good thing, but I had everything I was gonna say ready, and when I took the stand, I forgot most of it. What I remembered was hard to hear because my voice was shaking like I was in front of a firing squad. I sputtered out something to the effect of, I know it's probably wrong to laugh when someone is telling a cop about specific acts his mother is committing in hell, but I don't think that's any reason to ruin a perfectly spotless record. The judge turns to the prosecutor and asks about my record. The prosecutor brought up the Honey Farms larceny charge. I hadn't considered that since I hadn't been actually arrested that time. I just had to pay a fine. The gavel came down. Guilty. Still, after 25 years of speaking in public professionally, my voice still quivers when I have to speak in front of authority figures. Interviewers ask me all the time if I ever die on stage. I don't count the times that I've fallen apart merely speaking at a local city council meeting or trying to talk my way out of a ticket. Those times, I die on my ass every time. This time I was given just another small fine for disturbing the peace, but it made me even edgier to get the fuck out of Worcester. Until then, I kept getting into trouble. That summer, Dad and Gail had gone off for a week's vacation to Prince Edward Island, and we immediately threw a massive party that filled the house with local miscreants and eventually led to fights spilling across the neighbors' lawns. We also realized that Gail's Toyota Corolla wagon had a faulty ignition switch that you could start just by turning it with a butter knife. Joy rides abound! In the morning, we cleaned up, putting all the empty Coors bottles back in their cases. They were returnable bottles back then, worth a nickel apiece back at the Packy. We stood proud in the kitchen when the stack of cases reached just inches from the drop ceiling. That weekend, I took an overnight trip with Mother up to York Beach in Maine. On the way back the next day, we happened to pass Dad and Gail on the highway, also heading home from their vacation. Oh, fuck. The cases of beer are still in the kitchen. I told Mother, and we drove like hell to beat them back to the house. An iffy proposition, seeing as how often Mother had to stop to pee. We didn't make it. Not only did Dad and Gail walk in to find our monument in the middle of an otherwise spotless kitchen, they had church friends there to meet them. I can't imagine what my father could have come up with to excuse it. And Gail had written down the mileage on her car before she left. She wasn't stupid. In the meantime, I got several jobs that didn't check your references. I worked overnight making donuts with Weird Joe Vancelette. Another Job Corps flunk out. I washed dishes for a while. I was a security guard at a warehouse for a few days where I looked so young and so ridiculous in the uniform that at one point someone said to me, "Excuse me, miss." I tried to fake a slip and fall scam, but I couldn't even fall down correctly, so I quit. I had two jobs that lasted less than 90 minutes. One was stuffing circulars into newspapers on a conveyor belt. "I'll be right back. I have to go to the bathroom." Another was mopping up after shows at the Centrum, which was the major concert arena downtown. "I'll be right back. I have to go to the bathroom." Keith started with me at the Centrum at the same time when we walked out, and we walked out the back, taking the mop and mop bucket with us. We had walked out in the middle of a shift one night from the Gay Diner a little while before. And now we wanted our old jobs back. And we thought if we brought Simmy the mop bucket as a peace offering, we could get our jobs back. How could he say no? The shortest job, though, was yet to come. Nah, fuck it. Chad Shank, do this.
One fateful night, Keith and I were at the diner after hours, just fucking around and eating for free on a night off, when Cookie and her husband came in. She was on me like body armor, grabbing my dick through my pants, nuzzling up in my neck. "Why don't you come home with us tonight?" I didn't have the excuse of having to work, and on paper, she certainly wasn't anything you'd ever want to poon. She looked like the fat neighbor kid's mother from the movie Better Off Dead. If you got that reference, you should put this book down and high-five yourself. For the rest, think heavyset, bouffant hairdo, overly made up lunch lady in her 40s. But then again, I'm 17 and she's twisting my cock through my pants, which is a strong sales technique. So I became Doug Stanhope, male prostitute. I thought I was slick as gypsy moth caterpillar guts. So are you going to make it worth my while? Oh, absolutely. Still grabbing my dick. You'd better go check with your husband. Meanwhile, I'd run back to Keith and updated him. You're never going to believe this. Cookie's going to pay me to fuck her. Even then, I knew the value of a good story. If I could come back and tell that a woman paid me to fuck her, then I was a king. Nobody besides Keith had to know she was a hideous beast. My fatal mistake was in never naming a price and getting it up front. Something I'd learned later from getting prostitutes. For some reason, I had 500 bucks in my head. I have no idea why. It seemed like the number someone would pay you to fuck them. I should have said it out loud. We left and drove to their house out in the sticks of one of the neighboring towns. Maybe Holden, maybe Rutland, upper middle class. The whole time I'm playing it like I'm some experienced gigolo while I'm really shitting my pants. They gave me a beer and then we were in their bedroom where they took off their clothes. Thank God it was dimly lit. I don't know if I was naked then, but I knew I didn't know what the fuck to do next. I don't do guys. As though I've done this 1,000 times and have my regular rules. That's okay, sweetheart. My husband can go first and you can watch. He piled on top of her and grunted it out, probably even more repulsive than walking in on my mother and stepfather. I just stood in the doorway like I was witnessing a murder. Any attempts at appearing like a seasoned pro were torpedoed. I couldn't have appeared more awkward if I'd been openly crying, which I'm sure I wanted to do. He finished before his heart exploded, and now it was my turn. The great thing about being a teenager is you could get a boner naked in an ice storm, whether you wanted one or not. That's how boners work at that age. Random, unannounced, and sometimes inappropriately timed. There must have been unsolicited teenage boners in concentration camps. It had to happen. Think about that. Statistical probability. This time, Ready Wood worked in my favor. I got on top of Cookie. My imaginary price would have doubled if she were on top. And gave a few strokes, but my dick kept slipping out. Hang on, she said. It's probably just a little messy. She went to the toilet and queefed out a towel full of her husband's seed and then plopped back down in the bed in position. I should have leapt out a window. I mounted her and was done in under a minute. I'm sure I apologized for my barely legal faux pas, and they said we could wait a while and try again. Instead, I just went to bed on the couch. Needless to say, the morning was uncomfortable. The husband had to drive me back to Worcester in near silence. I was on my way home, and so far there had been no mention of payment, aside from an early, tenuous promise of Cookie making it, quote, worth my while, unquote. Which, for all I know, could have meant the privilege of boning her. I was now petrified at the thought of going back to Keith and having to admit that I did this for free. Finally, he cut the tension and said, "So, did you have a good time?" My voice croaked. Well, I was kind of expecting some kind of financial compensation. Unable to keep the question mark out of the end of my sentence. "Ah, yes," he said in a fatherly tone. "My wife likes to live in a fantasy world sometimes. How much were you expecting?" That $500 figure dropped like penny stocks. $50? "I can give you 30. "That's fine." So long as I got paid a dollar, the story stood. I was officially, if only technically, a paid male escort. I could put that on my resume next to petty larcenist and high school dropout.
I was about to turn 18 and become a free man. Dad and Gail had had enough of me. Carla, fake name, was contemptible. I watched her slap my father in some fit of pompous frustration. It was like seeing someone kick a kitten. I punched her right in her fat, fucking greasy, pimpled face, and I never felt bad about it. I was raised you never hit a woman, but it's instinctual that you never hit my dad. I hate her to this day. She continued to live with my father even after her mother eventually left him. He was a pushover, and he claimed he liked the company. He should have just got a dog. I'm not sure when I decided that I wanted to move to Hollywood to be an actor. I know I had taken an acting class and I did a play that advertised auditions in the newspaper, but I don't remember having any strong passion for the art. I liked the attention. It was more of a pipe dream of being famous and the prestige of being one of the few people that ever seemed to leave that shithole town. I know that I was at least thinking about it at Christmas just before I turned 18, when I found this inscribed on a greeting card from me to my mother. Ma, with all the money in the world and the sunniest resort with the nicest looking ladies, Christmas just wouldn't be Christmas without you. And when I leave for the other coast, the only tears shed will be shed for you. I love you, Ma. Sorry if this sounds like a Harlequin romance. Merry Christmas. Love, Doug. Jeez, I fucking choke up on all the shit I actually wrote or that's written. That's not the book. Exactly 3 months later, I turned 18. My father, maybe unsure if I really planned on leaving, left me this letter.
Russell H. Stanhope, Coordinator of Science. March 29th, 1985. Dear Doug, as usual, I did not do a very good job of celebrating your birthday, but I really did not know what you would like. Hope that in the next week or so we can have dinner together, any place which you would like. I do have a rather strange birthday present for you, and I hope that 10 years from now you will appreciate it. When a bird grows up in the nest, it reaches a point where everything is being supplied, and the situation is so comfortable that the bird stops developing properly. Sometimes it takes a bit of a kick in the fanny so that it can try out its wings and find out how exciting the world really is. I think that pretty much describes your situation right now. And as long as the nest is there, your growth will be stunted. Your presents will include: on April 8th, you will have a final $130 from your bonds to take to court. Also, any money that I have given you for the truck, concert tickets, and whatever will be written off so that you and I are free and clear. Your appointment for the eye examination will be paid, plus the cost of glasses or contacts, as you may decide. On April 13th, you will get $100 in cash from Gail and I as a birthday present. When you get your own place, we will try and help out with the furnishings, including the fridge if you need it, dishes, chairs, and similar materials. The bed and the bureau, of course, are yours. Finally, you will have free room and board through Saturday, April 13th. Starting this weekend, we will be moving things around, getting ready for the plumber and heating contractor. You will have a bed available for you, but no overnight guests, on either the basement or first floor levels through April 13th. You will have your new place ready for that night of April 13th. I shall take off the extra car insurance as of April 15th. There are many training opportunities available if you decide to take advantage of them, and I will always be available to help and advise. Happy birthday, with many, many more to come. Love, Dad.
I still choke up reading that because I know how hard it was for him to write it, how much carping he had to take from his wife to put his foot down, not to mention the shit we put him through to bring him to that point. There was an ocean of reasons I deserved to be kicked out of the nest. It didn't matter. I was leaving anyway. Though it was going to be a while before the full amount of grandma's dead money came through, the stock portion from Cincinnati Millicron, where my grandfather had worked, that was released to us and I cashed it in post-haste. No need for the fridge and the dishes, Pop. I'm going to Hollywood. lot of gay parts in this book, and I was trying to make sure Chad Shank had to read all the gay parts, but I think I had to read a few. Hey, Chad Shank, read this gay part.
Chapter 5, Hollywood. Scams, queers, scamming queers, and queering scams. I took the Amtrak from Worcester to Los Angeles in April of 1985 with $450 in my pocket, no plan whatsoever. I didn't need a plan. Rules don't apply to me was a phrase I was fond of saying any time I got away with something I shouldn't have. In those years of blissful ignorance, rules don't apply. Caution comes only after grand miscalculation. Until you fuck up profoundly in life, you can skip through the minefields like it's the sound of music. I figured the train was a great way to see the country, and it was. I hadn't seen Bupkis past New Jersey, save for the few trips in the truck across the frozen wasteland of the upper Midwest. I still love the train to this day, but now I get a sleeping car for anything longer than a few hours, and doze almost as soundly as in POW's truck bed. Sleeping in a chair for 3.5 days is a lot easier when you're 18. The first train went from Worcester to Chicago, and even though I still looked like a 13-year-old, I got the bartender to serve me beer. The bar car was usually empty, so I think he was just happy to have company. The second train, from Chicago to Los Angeles, wasn't so easy. The bartender initially refused to serve me, but I had 43 hours to badger him and at some point break him down, with the stipulation that I get out at a stop in Albuquerque and try to find him weed. I remember just standing in the train station looking around like there might be a guy that looked like a pot dealer, whatever that looked like. There wasn't. But the bartender admired my fortitude and served me anyway, making it a hell of a lot easier to sleep curled up in a ball in a vaguely reclining seat. It was good to be small. By the time I got out at Union Station in downtown L.A., I'd been on the train for so long that my equilibrium was shattered. For the first day, it still felt like my body was swaying. I checked into the closest cheap hotel I could find. It had a name like the Grand and was anything but, and cost about $35, which was a lot for someone with only $450 to start a life. I was happy just to be getting off the street. I had no idea that downtown L.A. wasn't Hollywood, and it hadn't begun to be gentrified yet. It was all skid row and frightening, to say the least. I found a coffee shop and a newspaper, thinking maybe they had ads in the classified for actors. And guess what? They did. I could also make thousands part-time from home stuffing envelopes. My future was bright. The first scam I fell for was from an ad for Hollywood Theatrical Studios, an acting school that sold itself as an earn-while-you-learn program of acting class as well as placement. I took the bus from downtown to Hollywood and was soon relieved as the decay of downtown turned into some of the palm trees I'd been expecting. The owner of the school, Maurice Kosloff, was an old movie producer who had a few movie posters from the 1940s framed behind his desk with his name in small print at the bottom. He'd put you on camera to gauge your level of talent, allegedly to see how much training you'd need. The real angle was making enough small talk to gauge how much money they could siphon out of you. Don't worry, he'd tell you. They were going to send you out on acting jobs while you were training, so you'd just make that money back. Well, heck yes, sign me up. I had a cousin who was an actor in L.A. named Grant Forsberg. He lived in a nice apartment in Beverly Hills with his hot soap opera actress girlfriend Deborah Goodrich. He was 7 years older than me, and although he was one of only 3 cousins I knew, I still didn't know him that well. I was dead set against leeching off him. It would have felt like cheating. But I did make contact and stayed a couple nights on their couch while I looked for a place of my own. Short on cash, I moved into an incredibly seedy weekly rental rooming house called the St. Francis, now the Gershwin, at Western and Hollywood. It was somewhere around $45 a week and absolutely terrifying. The front desk was surrounded in thick, discolored plexiglass, and you had to talk to them through a small hole. I remember coming in one night while some dude was randomly beating the shit out of a homeless guy in the entrance for seemingly no reason. He wasn't yelling or anything. He seemed bored, like he was just doing it as a workout. The guy behind the plexiglass didn't even look up. Each floor had a payphone, and people would quarrel over it like it was prison. I remember calling Mother Collect on that phone more than once, scared shitless, telling her that everything was fine. Mother was in the process of getting the fuck out of Massachusetts herself. She'd graduated massage school and was moving down to Florida to start up her own massage business. She'd worked briefly in Worcester for a chiropractor before the move. In her things, I found a reference letter he'd written for her. Obviously in jest, but indicative of the relationship she'd foster. Mother, at her best, made those kind of relationships. She brought the best of the wicked out of people. She made people at ease with being raunchy, even led them into it. Now she was bringing that vulgar charm to Florida.
A letter of reference from the Main Street Chiropractic offices, May 1st, 1985. To whom it may concern, Bonnie Kirk, or Crazy Kinky Cuddles Kirk, as she's better known to most of her clients, is a warm, wonderful human being. Well, a little different from a normal human being. When she gives you a massage, you or any other guy will know for sure that she will fill a lonely void in your life. In fact, she really has a very special talent for giving an uplifting experience to guys in our area when their wives are out of town. Bonnie, or Crazy Cuddles, always remembers you when she sees you later at a restaurant. She will hug and kiss you as she wiggles in your lap, no matter who is with you. Some of us have had a few problems with our ex-wives, but good old Cuddles Kirk was a real help to all of us as she helped us over our losses. If Crazy Cuddles Kirk sets up shop in Florida, it'll be your gain and our loss, as she will leave a lot of lonely guys here. Crazy Cuddles Kirk always gives a great massage. Signed, George.
She'd had another breakup with POW and was heading out, kicking it blind like I was. Thanks to AA, she had new friends immediately in Florida and was traveling all over the state. Daytona Beach, Key West, gay bars, titty bars, comedy shows, like it was her own nonstop bachelorette party. She really didn't need to drink to have a good time. Being away from all the gloom and baggage of Massachusetts was enough. We were both out on our own, on great adventures for the first time in our lives, and we racked up some healthy phone bills, hers, keeping each other updated. I wasn't getting any of these earn while you learn acting gigs that they told me about, but at least I was meeting people at the school. Some good, some not as much. All of us suckers. Joe Miller was a kid from Kansas who, except for the bleached yellow hair, looked every bit like a kid named Joe Miller from Kansas. He was about my age, freckled and with a cornpone accent that hid from me and only me, it seemed, that he was a raging homosexual. He stayed with me at the St. Francis a few nights with our eye on getting a regular apartment. Joe had stories, big stories. He told me about how he'd been taken away from his family as a child as part of a government experiment because of his paranormal abilities. Mother always had a predilection for psychics and had taken me to some as a teenager. While I was not fully sold, I wasn't by any means the cranky skeptic I am now. While Joe Miller's story was so implausible, I still wanted to believe it. Joe had a car, and as our money dwindled, I proposed we drive to Las Vegas and use his psychic powers to take down the house. If his story were all fiction, I figured he'd find an excuse. But he was fully on board, heightening my fantasies of coming back stinking rich. Halfway to Vegas, we stopped at a rest area when the car overheated. Joe put his stupid face over the radiator and took the cap off. His telekinetic powers must have been so strong that he was immediately awash in boiling water. He ran around screaming in circles and rolled like they were actual flames. It burned the fuck out of him, but he still didn't want to turn back. We made it as far as the casinos at the state line, but with my baby face and his now giant red blobs of water blisters, we were shooed out of every casino within minutes. We never had the chance to test his supernatural talents. It was a long and dejected drive back to L.A. Days after, Joe came to my room and, with great theatrics, told me he'd been so broke he had to go out and hustle men on Santa Monica Boulevard, a regular haunt for gay prostitutes. He said that most of the time he didn't even have to do anything. He'd just give them a sob story and they'd give him money. Regardless, I was frightened at how quickly someone could slip so far down that they'd have to turn to that. I was clueless that this hadn't been much of a stretch for Joe Miller. At some point, we were too broke even for the St. Francis and had to sleep in his car for a few nights. That's when he finally made an advance on me in a sad, pensive way, like Philip Seymour Hoffman in Boogie Nights. I wasn't offended, but I was somewhat dumbstruck in my own naivete. Later, I told my cousin Grant about it. Grant, who had met him, saw that he was so obviously gay that he considered maybe I was trying to hide that we were secretly a couple. I had no idea, and it would happen again. In fact, this whole chapter gets really, really gay. Joe and I stopped hanging out. His bullshit stories had gotten thicker and thicker. Having a gay telekinetic roommate isn't a big deal until you're living in a car. He drifted into full-time gay hustling, and I drifted literally into the background. By now, I had signed up with a few casting companies for work in movies as an extra. If you ever saw such blockbusters as Hamburger, the motion picture, or the TV movie of the week, Tough Love, with Lee Remick and Bruce Dern, that was me walking around way in the background for a second. Lee Remick said hi to me at the craft service table. I couldn't wait to call Mother and tell her about my first brush with fame. If I hadn't been so slipshod in deleting Mother's hoard postmortem, I'll bet there was a VHS or three of Tough Love in there, queued up to the second I walked by.
Backstage West was the actor's rag that would list all the auditions and casting information, and it was always littered with ads for telemarketing positions promising boatloads of money. So one day I put on the only suit I'd brought and went down for an interview. The place was a gutted apartment on the second floor over the shops on La Cienega Boulevard, directly across from a car wash. Everyone was bedraggled, sitting at highway salvage desks, yelling into phones. I noticed the manager had a water bong on his desk. I guess I didn't really need to wear the suit. In fact, I probably looked like a little tiny narc at first glance. The scam was selling toner. You had a lead on an index card for a small business, along with the type of copying machine they had and the name of the person in charge of the purchasing. The pitch went like this. Yes, Barbara? Hi, this is Doug calling on the Xerox. How's that machine working for you out there? You don't say you're calling from Xerox. You insinuate it. The reason for the call is we just had a price increase for the toner and the developer you use for that machine. Now, normally we give you a 30-day notification in the event of a price increase. We didn't get that notice out to you in time, so what I did, I set aside two cases of each at the old price, and that's going to put into effect a price freeze for the next 6 months, so you'll still be paying at the old price. I'm really sorry we didn't get that notification out to you. I'm going to get these two cases out right away. Do you want that COD or do you want the 30-day open billing? Great. Theory being in the scam that a lot of these purchasers really have no idea what they pay, since it isn't their own money, they just write the check. We'd send out inferior product at several times the regular price and nobody's the wiser. Until someone did wise up, and by that time the phone room had packed up and moved across town with a different name. The job gave you a $100 bonus just for showing up on time. The job started at 5 a.m. calling East Coast businesses, and with the sad sack drunks and drug addicts that worked there, getting them in on time was always a problem. At this point, Grant had rented me a ugly duckling rent-a-car. It was a 1980s Chrysler Cordoba, and it was a boat, so it had plenty of room in the back seat to sleep. Mornings were still dreadful, but I could just park it in front of work, and the boss would bang on the window on his way into the office to wake me up. I never missed my bonus. My first week, I made $435, by far the biggest paycheck in my life. Before that, it had been $180 for 50-some hours